This is Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Ronoff.
We're talking today about the history of environmental crisis, humans and their impact on nature.
Nature?
Yep.
What do you mean exactly by that? What do you mean by nature?
Nature.
I thought you'd say that, so I sent my friend Rachel Quimby out to find a real answer.
What is nature?
Trees, squirrels, rabbits, lots of clouds, and boring old rocks, a grassy field with flowers, woods, and baseball parks. Animals, except for if they live in a house or in a zoo. Nature is lots of things.
Are you sitting on it?
Not really.
Where is nature?
Outside. Not that far. Nature is about a foot out of my house.
Is there any nature in your house?
Well, if it's in a pot. Nature is sounds of cars, fire trucks. Lovely. Nice. Well, mostly in forests. And sometimes a little scary. And then all of a sudden something eats you. To me, as long as it's pretty, it's nature.
Wow. That's great.
That's terrific.
Those are the very insightful second and third graders from the Charlottesville Community Jewish Day School, speaking to our own hard-hitting reporter there, Rachel Quimby. Thanks, kids.
Yeah, well, I could really relate to that. All of a sudden, something eats you. That's basically my take on nature.
But I like it, too, when nature begins about a foot outside my house.
That's a danger zone, that 1 foot and 12 inches of danger.
I'm curious, did you guys think about nature when you were kids? I mean, I grew up in Miami, and there was nothing natural. Even the AstroTurf was not natural.
I was a Boy Scout, and I loved nature because it was a way to get merit badges.
Yeah, well, I was Boy Scout too, Ed, and the way I got badges was to identify the makes and models of cars.
Well, you heard one kid identify trucks and cars as nature.
Yeah, and now we name a lot of our trucks and cars after nature.
We do.
Yeah. Well, it's not just second graders that wrestle with the definition of nature. In fact, some very prominent historians worry about what nature is as well. A little over a decade ago, a guy who I certainly think of as the dean of environmental historians, Professor William Cronin, laid down the gauntlet in a very provocative essay that he called The Trouble with Wilderness. In The Trouble with Wilderness, Cronin argued that there's a tendency to look at nature as something that exists beyond humans. And once you put humans into nature, then it's no longer pristine, it's no longer nature. Well, Cronin says this is ridiculous because, of course, nature includes human beings, and human beings are constantly interacting with that nature. A little while ago, I sat down with Bill Cronin, a guy who really is trying to put a little history back into our understanding of nature.
One of the most interesting ways, especially in the United States, that we have learned to think about nature is through this category, this human idea called the wild or wilderness, which is a way we use to label those parts of nature that we think are most remote from us, most separate from us, most different from us. Sitting in this radio studio talking to each other, it's easy to imagine that we are outside of nature. And yet, if you look closely at the technologies that are allowing us to have this conversation, where our food came from this morning, where the energy that's coursing over these wires is coming from, instantly that set of journeys take us back out into the natural world that enables our lives to be possible. Human beings are never outside of nature.
Since you're an historian, why don't you tell me when humans started thinking about the wilderness as being something other than humanness?
I would say that the big change, the real transformation in the way we think about wild places begins to happen in the 18th century. At the beginning of that century, most Europeans wouldn't have been caught dead going to a place like the Alps. They thought of the Alps as ugly, horrible, terrifying, unpleasant places. And by the end of that century, with the dawn of Romanticism, people are actively seeking out the mountains as places where they can get closer to God than anywhere else on the face of the planet.
That seems like such a radical shift to me, to go over the course of a century from, in essence, the place that the devil hung out to some place that was godly.
Well, it's a complicated change, but the quick version of it would be the 18th century, of course, is the moment at which scientific rationalism seems like it's going to explain everything that there is in the universe. And for some scientists, some thinkers. It's a world in which there no longer is a need for a God, or at least not a God that is anything other than a watchmaker, a creature who creates a universe, sets it in motion, and then it ticks away like a machine. But for a lot of romantics, looking at that mechanical vision of an Enlightenment universe, losing a world that had the mystery, the grandeur that God provided in that landscape was not something they were willing to sacrifice. So what they found on the mountaintop was a rediscovery of the sacred, a rediscovery of those things in the world that they held dear because they were transcendent and greater than just human.
Well, look, I'm a simple-minded 20th century historian at heart, so I've been dying to ask you this question for years. When I see wilderness, I get there via an SUV commercial. Could you fast forward a little bit and explain to me how wilderness became associated with sport utility vehicles?
Oh, there's a big one. The idea of wilderness as a place of wild freedom, as a place where especially Americans go to express their sense of liberty and freedom, is one of the things that grows over the course of the 20th century. The movement to protect wilderness, oddly, is driven by a concern about motorized recreation. It was actually people who were actually worried about the National Park Service building roads into roadless places. And so they began to organize for roadless areas that would be legally protected as such. And the result was the great 1964 Wilderness Act, in which the United States actually legally declared that there would be some parts of the American landscape which would be forever protected from roads. The irony, as your question suggests, is that as we move forward later into the 20th century, more and more Americans are able to avail themselves of off-road vehicles, snowmobiles, other devices that no longer require roads to take you into the deep wild. And so curiously, the people who are drawn to using those vehicles are drawn actually by some of the same values of wanting to be in that glorious, beautiful, wild, free country. At the very moment that their presence, for many other users of the wilderness, represents a desecration of that wild.
Bill Cronin is a professor of history and environmental science at the University of Wisconsin. Madison, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure talking to you too, Brian. Thanks.
Brian, that was a really interesting conversation you had with Bill Cronin. I've always really admired him and wondered, you know, how he could think that wilderness seemed somehow so tied to humans. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it actually did make a lot of sense.
Well, I think what Bill's saying is that the nature outside that we construct or invent that we see really reflects the way we understand our own natures. That is, it is our nature to make things, right?
Yeah.
It's our nature to be part of this thing and to fulfill our destiny. That notion of destiny, progress, those are all profoundly important modern ideas. And we just have doubts about all that stuff now.
Yeah.
And I do think that we indulge in a number of rituals today that are almost religious rituals around the environment that may have much more spiritual meaning to us.
Well, he used the word sacred, didn't he?
Yeah, but I'm not talking about actually going out and experiencing nature. I know many people who recycle religiously. I really think that 30 years from now, environmental historians may be wondering whether this wasn't more effective as a sacrament than...
Oh, I love that, just sort of the ritualistic separating of the blue and the clear and the brown.
Yeah, well, what makes you feel good anyway, history guy?
You know, having all these conversations about nature, it's hard not to think about this pristine jewel in our own backyard, Shenandoah National Park. But we know that even that has a history, probably because it has a parkway across the top of it. And so to find out about that story, we sent our reporter Jesse Dukes up to the Shenandoah on a little history expedition. Let's hear what he found.
This is maybe my 30th time visiting Shenandoah National Park. And usually when I come up here, I'm trying to remember what the world looks like without people or roads or houses. But this time, I'm with a park ranger and we're looking for something specific.
Well, striking out. This happens every time.
The only problem is, we can't find it.
It's not looking familiar?
My guide is interpretive specialist Claire Comer, and she wants to show me a site where humans once lived.
Well, and I know at this particular site, there's shoes, there's shovels.
Before it was founded in 1936, Shenandoah National Park was just an idea. One that began in 1924 when the federal government decided we needed an eastern park. Something like Yellowstone or Yosemite, but closer to where all the people lived.
It looks so different.
Wealthy people from Washington were already visiting the Blue Ridge, most famously at Skyland Lodge. Skyland was a kind of dude ranch of the East, where people could stay in rustic cabins, ride horses, or hunt. Its owner, George Pollock, saw a national park as a way to bring more visitors to the area, and he recruited some of his friends in government and business to the cause.
So they filled out a nomination form and sent that in, and this was chosen as one of the sites to look at.
The federal government had a specific idea of what a park should be. In the mold of Yellowstone and Yosemite, they wanted stunning beauty, sites for fishing and hiking, and access to roads. But most importantly, they wanted it to be a wilderness, free of human settlement and development. So the Virginians fudged a little bit on their application.
They said that this area was pristine and free of inhabitations or developments.
This, as they knew full well, was not true.
Now look, there's a rock pile.
And Claire has just found the proof of that.
And there's the shoes. See?
Yeah.
A little pair of boots.
Wow.
What we've found is one of some 500 home sites that existed before there ever was a Shenandoah National Park.
And evidently something collapsed here, maybe a chimney or
But this one is not just any home site. This one belonged to the great-grandfather of Claire Comer. He actually lived in the valley below, and he paid tenant farmers to live up here and graze his cattle.
The nice thing about it is it stayed about 10 degrees cooler in the summer, so the cows were much more comfortable up here.
You said something about driving the cattle up.
Uh-huh.
Like a cattle drive? Like drive them up into the mountains?
Mm-hmm. Right up Tanner's Ridge Road.
That's amazing. So they would drive, what, like 50 cattle up right up into the Blue Ridge?
Probably way more than that.
Along with the thousands of farmers and ranchers in the mountains, there was also industry, mines, apple orchards, tan bark harvesting, lumbering. So in 1926, when the federal government okayed a future park, the Virginians had a problem. What were they going to do with all these people living in the mountains?
Here's a, like an old canning jar.
It just so happens that at the same time, sociologists and anthropologists had begun to focus their attention on the people living in remote mountain communities.
The hollow dweller has no ordered routine of toil. He is unafflicted by the weariness of those doing the work of the world.
This is scholar Nancy Martin Perdue reading me an excerpt of a book called Hollow Folk, written in 1933 by journalist Thomas Henry and sociologist Mandel Sherman.
His affections are much closer to the animal level than in the population at large. Death of loved ones does not plunge him into the depths and darkness of grief which humanity has evolved.
The people promoting the park didn't commission the so-called work of sociology, but they also didn't shy away from using this image of the backward mountaineer to forward the idea that the residents of the Blue Ridge should be removed, not just because Virginia wanted a park, but that they should be removed for their own good. The claim was that these people were devolving in the mountains and needed to rejoin civilization.
Mountain life not only does not tend to stimulate mental growth, but also acts as a handicap. The older the child, the less ambition he appears to
have. In the end, the park promoters got their way, and in 1934, the state of Virginia decided that the people living in the 200,000 acres that was slated to become Shenandoah National Park had to leave.
And people came in and moved them out. Burned their house down in some cases, took their things, and carted them off to some other place.
So, what's left behind up in these Blue Ridge Hills? Well, nature enthusiasts, like me, and people working for the park, like Claire Comer.
I want to see the people that visit the park for the reason that it was established. They come here to hike, to recreate with their families, to feel some recreation through the recuperative powers of nature.
But that's not all she wants them to feel.
I want to simply make them aware of the sacrifice, that this did not come without cost to some people.
Why couldn't you have a park that allowed people to stay?
Well, I think, you know, you'd run into all kinds of things. If the park's purpose is to be where you can walk through virtual wilderness and experience nature, then what choices are you going to make about what they build and how they improve their homes as time goes on? You know, how do you museumify a group of people? You don't.
Museumifying the land, on the other hand, now that's something we can all get behind, right? It's what the government was trying to do when it started creating national parks more than a century ago. And it's what's drawn me up to these mountains for years. I want to leave civilization behind, to spend time in a wild space that hasn't been shaped by humans. After this trip, it's going to be a little harder to experience it that way. When I got back to my car at this enormous clearing, known as Big Meadows, I realized for the first time that it's not a natural meadow. Claire explained that it was probably cleared by Native Americans before they were displaced. Now, the park maintains the meadow pretty much as the Indians did, by mowing and burning. The hands of humans are all over this place. We just don't let them live here anymore.
That's Jesse Dukes, a reporter here in Charlottesville, Virginia. You can listen to oral history recordings of some of the people removed from the Shenandoah at our website, backstoryradio.org.
Wouldn't you say that the story makes Cronin's point pretty powerfully? That his human imprint, as Jesse said, is all over this place.
Right.
Now, there are different ways that human imprint can be there, through the remains of previous peoples who have lived in the region, Indians or earlier settlers or even recent 20th century residents. But it's also the larger world that humans have created, the atmosphere, the pollution that's being suffered.
Yeah, that's the Shenandoah National Park is one of the most polluted places in the United States right now because it's a kind of a filter that catches the pollution washing down from the Midwest.
Yeah, and what also struck me is that you have here in really the mid-1920s a great example of economic development using nature. Why is this park created in the first place?
Well, that would be tourism,
wouldn't it? It's tourism, and what a coincidence. This is right when Americans are really beginning to get a lot of automobiles.
Well, that's the history of Yellowstone, too, isn't it, Brian?
It's trains rather than automobiles.
Are we saying that they wish they hadn't created the Shenandoah National Park?
No, I think it's more complicated than that. I think it makes us think hard about everything we do. I mean,
but I don't want to think hard about everything I do. I sometimes want to go out and enjoy apple trees in the spring or in the fall. And, you know, you could argue millions and millions of people have enjoyed
them. I just want you to enjoy them, but feel bad about it at the same time. Okay?
That'd be called historical perspective, wouldn't it? Right? Not a problem, Peter. We can do that.
Well, that's all we have time for today. But we want to keep the conversation going on our website. That's backstoryradio.org. Leave a comment about today's show and help us plan our future shows. Our website has a list of upcoming show topics, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on these topics. That's backstoryradio.org.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field and Rachel Quimby.
Alan Williams engineered our show, and Dave Stipe mastered it. Andrew Windham is our executive producer.
Trey Mitchell is our webmaster. Our theme music was composed by Gabi Alter. And special thanks today to Elliot Majerzik and Charles and Nancy Perdue.
We'll be back next week, making history, shaking history, and breaking history.
Come on back, y'all.
Hear the valley of the Shenandoah.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation, Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein, and the W.L. Lyons Brown, Jr. Charitable Foundation, Caroline Feeney, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, J. M. Weinberg, Dr. Anna McGee, and an anonymous donor. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Darling, you.